Welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, March 18th. I'm your reader, Mary Neff. Before we head to the Gazette's front page, we will take a look at the weather today. If you don't know it already, it's cold out there. It is windy as well. Winds from the northwest at 20 to 30 miles an hour with a high of 26, unseasonably cool. The low tonight's going to be 12. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with a wind of 10 to 20 miles an hour and a high of around 37, a low of 24. Then on Monday, partly cloudy, winds pick up just a little bit again, 15 to 25, but that high is going to be getting up to 50, a low of 33. How does that compare with our normal? Normally the high around this time would be 47 for a high and 28 for a low, but in 1941, we had a record low of 2 degrees and a record high in 2012 of 82 degrees. Meteorologist Corey Thompson has provided this top weather story, titled Cold St. Patrick's But Not Coldest. Temperatures on Friday only reached 27 degrees for a high, and that was an early day reading while most of us were asleep. The St. Patrick's Day holiday was characterized by brisk northwest winds and lower wind chills. This would place the day as tied for the fifth coldest St. Patrick's Day on record in Cedar Rapids, along with 1939 and 1960. It's still a far cry from the coldest of all time, which was 15 degrees in 1941. Mr. Thompson says cold St. Patrick's Days have been somewhat common in the past few years, with three of the last five recording highs in the 30s. We're not far away from the hottest ever, though. 82 degrees was the record high for the date set in 2012. Among the Gazette's front page stories is this one from Marissa Payne titled, Could German Serve as Head of Police? Dateline Cedar Rapids. 3 days after Cedar Rapids Police Chief Wayne German turned 66 years old on March 4th, Iowa Law Enforcement Academy staff emailed German about reaching the maximum age for officers and asked whether he would continue working as a civilian employee. The email, which the Gazette received through a public records request, came 2 days before City Manager Jeff Pomerantz told the police department that city officials were assessing German's certification status since he had reached age 66, when peace officer certifications expire under Iowa code. Jill Polich, the records clerk of ILEA, which handles law enforcement certifications, emailed German on March 7th to inquire about a change in his status. Quote, I am reaching out in regards to the maximum age limit for certified peace officers as outlined in Iowa Code 400.17, end quote. Our records indicate that you have reached the age of 66, she continued. Will you be staying on as a civilian employee? Asked if German responded, Academy Director Brady Carney said, quote, ILEA cannot discuss whether or not we've had discussions about a particular certification under Iowa Code, end quote. A statement from the city manager's office said German remains a city employee on paid administrative leave while the city assesses a confidential personnel matter. His title remains police chief. German has not responded to requests for comment. It is not clear when or if German has notified ILEA of his status change. Pomerantz's March 9th email to the police department stated it was the ILEA's position that all peace officer certifications expire when the officer turns 66, regardless of position. In the meantime, Deputy Chief Tom Jonker will serve as acting chief until the matter is resolved. City officials indicated they are weighing the impacts of German staying on as a civilian head of the police department. The city manager's office responded, the city is aware of the ILEA email. But, the city manager's office said, the city performed an informal survey of other communities and provided a table titled Iowa Comparison Between Various Police Chief Positions and Public Safety Director Positions. It assesses the differences in police chiefs certified by ILEA compared with a public safety director. According to the comparison table, the certified police chief first directs operations of all divisions of the police department, also enforces laws and ordinances while directing long and short-term plans of a police department, then wears a uniform and carries equipment required for law enforcement duties, firearm, bulletproof vest, taser, baton, handcuffs. also uses an unmarked patrol vehicle, reviews all law enforcement data and documents to make decisions and direct operations of the department, and is certified by the National Crime Information Center, a computerized index of criminal justice information, including information on criminal records, fugitives, stolen properties, missing people, etc. A public safety director, on the other hand, directs the operations of all divisions, which could include fire or EMS, cannot enforce any laws or ordinances, attends work in business casual clothing and does not carry any equipment related to law enforcement, drives a personal vehicle or vehicle issued without law enforcement equipment, may or may not have the ability to review certain documents the police department receives from various agency partners, which are for law enforcement use only, and may not have reason to obtain certification, would need to provide a reason to justify certification to the National Crime Information Center. Both positions may participate as a law enforcement officer at events such as neighborhood meetings, city council meetings, and protests, according to the comparison table. Carney said local forms of government are outside of ILEA's statutory purview when asked if a non-certified officer could lead a police department. That suggests it would be up to city leaders to decide whether to employ a non-certified head of the department. It's unknown whether other paths, if any, are being pursued. According to the city, it would take a city code change to employ a civilian police chief. The city did not identify which sections of code would need to change. For example, City Code Section 7.04, outlining the police chief's duties, says, quote, "It shall be the duty of the chief of police to cause the public peace to be preserved and enforce all the laws and ordinances of the city of which the police department must take cognizance," end quote. The comparison table shows the city's understanding is a non-certified head of the department could not enforce city laws and ordinances. City code does not explicitly require the police chief to be a certified officer, nor does it address age limits for the head of the police department. In the central Iowa city of Nevada, which has a population of nearly 7,000, according to 2020 census data, 67-year-old Ricardo Martinez II serves as the city's public safety director and police chief, though he is no longer a certified police officer. Martinez's case shows officers can serve in a civilian capacity past age 65, though their certification status changes. He, Martinez, is retiring this year, and the city's job description shows officials are seeking a replacement with ILEA certification. Martinez, who also serves on the ILEA Academy Council, said after consulting the Nevada City Administrator and others, city leaders were comfortable with him remaining in his position as a non-certified police chief when he turned 66 last February. Being a non-certified officer means he can't make arrests, pull people over, issue traffic tickets, or sign affidavits and complaints. Martinez said, "Being 67, I'm not going to go up to somebody's house and end up having to arrest somebody and wrestle them. I'm too old for that sort of thing. But I am old enough and smart enough to run my department because I've been doing it since 2011. Besides, Martinez said, he has not done any of those activities since approximately 2015. That department is made up of 11 sworn officers and 3 part-time officers. The Nevada Fire Department, which Martinez also oversees, is a volunteer department. For comparison, the Cedar Rapids Police Department has 212 officers and more than 60 non-sworn employees, according to the city website. In Cedar Rapids, Greg Smith serves as the fire chief, overseeing paid staff. The city's population is about 138,000. German could serve as a civilian employee, Martinez said, though he also would be barred from the same tasks Martinez no longer does, such as making arrests. Martinez said of serving as a civilian police chief, "That's what I'm doing, so he would be no different than what I have here. Of course, Cedar Rapids is a bigger city, and the demands are a little different, but I can tell you that his day-to-day responsibilities are really not going to change, whether he's certified or not." Martinez said he, as police chief, is required to let ILEA know if there's a change in an officer's status, whether they are promoted, become non-certified, quit, or move to another department. Leonard Matarese, research director and managing partner, at the Center for Public Safety Management, said in Florida and New York, police department heads do not have to be certified. Asked about the precedent it would set for a non-certified officer to serve as chief, Matarese said he didn't imagine city officials would ever hire someone without law enforcement experience. Even if German does not have the powers of a certified chief, Matarese said he doesn't see why German would need to be a sworn officer if he has over 3 decades of experience in law enforcement under his belt. German has served as police chief since 2012. Matarese said, if they think he's a good manager and he's managed the department well and he wants to do this, I can't imagine any reason not to keep him on. Officials have expressed some confusion, though, over conflicting language under state law and whether a legislative fix is needed to employ German as the leader of the department past age 65, though Martinez's case shows that's allowable under state's law. Iowa Code 362.10 states that, quote, the maximum age for a police officer, marshal, or firefighter employed for physical duty or the duty of fighting fires is 65 years of age, end quote. It does not explicitly mention police or fire chiefs. City officials have pointed to Iowa Code Chapter 400.17, in which the age limit is reiterated. Chapter 400.6 states department heads, like police chiefs, are exceptions to the rules outlined in Chapter 400. A bill in the Iowa legislature, Senate File 183, would adjust the wording of Iowa Code Section 362.10 to clarify that the age maximum applies to both part-time and full-time police officers and firefighters. This proposal, which advanced out of subcommittee Monday, doesn't say anything specifically regarding chiefs and other department heads. Larry Murphy, lobbyist for the Iowa Police Chiefs Association, in the Monday committee meeting said he believes the bill as drafted creates, quote, unintended consequences. It's not clear, Murphy said, whether police chiefs or fire chiefs are covered or not. Gary Grant, a lobbyist for the city of Cedar Rapids, echoed concerns of the Iowa Police Chiefs Association and supported lawmakers addressing police and fire chief ages. Grant said, when you have police chiefs and fire chiefs, they're largely administrative roles. Police chiefs aren't kicking down doors and fire chiefs aren't running into burning buildings. I think maybe looking at kind of eliminating some of those age requirements might be in order. And the end of the article does acknowledge that in addition to Marissa Payne as the author, Tom Barton contributed to this article. The second story on the Gazette's front page is from Elijah Decius, and it is titled Cedar Rapids Survivor Winner to Compete in New Show, subtitled After 3 seasons of Survivor, the Cedar Rapids Police Department investigator explains why she keeps competing. After 3 seasons of Survivor, including a win in 2017's Survivor Game Changers, Cedar Rapids police investigator Sarah Lacina is back on TV in a new competition franchise. After winning The Challenge USA, filmed earlier last year, Lacina has returned to compete in The Challenge World Championship, which pits teams from countries around the world against each other in a wide range of eye-popping challenges. The first season of the new competition is now 2 episodes in, both of which Lacina has survived. She said, I'm always trying to raise the bar and chase a higher achievement. That's kind of my addiction, my drug. I love just challenging myself and seeing what I can do. You keep setting the bar higher and higher, and you have to top that. Over the course of 2022, the homicide investigator for the Cedar Rapids Police Department spent about 12 weeks filming, 6 weeks for each version of The Challenge. She filmed in South Africa, but unlike her 3 seasons of Survivor, which requires alliance building between individually focused challenges, The Challenge requires teamwork through challenges ranging from driving blindfolded to high-stakes trivia at the top of a skyscraper. One of the most exciting challenges Lacina participated in, dangling by a cord from a building the height of Alliant Tower while answering trivia questions, has yet to be aired. Lacina said, I just have to remind my husband I wasn't just on vacation. It may look like it, but it's work. You have to be willing to work with anyone and everyone. After not talking to people she didn't like in her first season of Survivor, it's a lesson she carried with her. You don't have to like someone to work with them. As a homicide investigator who works to elicit confessions, knowing how to detect when others are lying or being deceptive has worked to her advantage through Survivor and the new competition, she said. Each episode consists of a daily challenge where the team in last place is automatically sent to an elimination round. The winning team earns immunity. Teams that didn't win or lose the daily challenge nominate and vote for two other teams to compete in the elimination round. At the end of each episode, a losing team is eliminated. After the first elimination, each contestant who has won a previous version of the challenge in their home country picks their, quote, legend, end quote, partner based on the order in which they completed a qualifying challenge. But success goes beyond what viewers see on the screen, and setting the bar higher for herself each time requires the support of Lacina's family and employer, too. Some of her biggest challenges are maintaining a balance at home with a demanding career while continuing to raise the bar in front of a national audience. With flexibility from ample PTO and a supportive employer, Lacina said she takes every opportunity she gets in appreciation for their scarcity. While some other contestants make a career out of reality TV competitions, she often contends with the guilt of leaving her family at home for weeks at a time. Lacina said, "It's extremely busy trying to do all of it, especially for my husband at home, who has to be a single dad while I'm gone. He encourages me to go, but after leaving two times in 1 year, he said, 'You're done for a while.'" The latest reality TV competition is her fifth in the last decade since she started her first challenge in 2013. After 10 years, she said she doesn't necessarily have the urge to prove anything, but she does have a goal in mind, saying, "My sole purpose in going back, if I'm going to leave my job and burn vacation time, is I want to come home with the big check. I'm going in, I have a job to do, and it's not just to have a good time," end quote. With a grand prize of $500,000, it's a serious attitude for a serious amount of cash. New episodes of The Challenge World Championship are released every Wednesday on streaming platform Paramount+. Moving to Iowa today, you'll see in this next article, it appears that the Gazette chose a real emphasis on law enforcement today. So this article is titled, "Lynn Deputy Retires After Nearly 43 Years." This is from Emily Anderson, Dateline Cedar Rapids. Captain Randy Rowland was 21 years old when he was hired as a deputy sheriff with the Lynn County Sheriff's Office in 1980. Now, at age 64, he's retiring after working with the county for almost 43 years. Rowland has the second longest career with the Sheriff's Office in recent memory, having worked with the department for 42 years, 11 months, and 17 days. Lieutenant Gene Parks, who retired in 2014, had the longest career, beating Rowland by only 11 days. Rowland said, "There's an age limit on how long you can be an officer in Iowa, age 65, so I could have stuck around a little bit longer, another year if I wanted, but it's time. After 43 years, it's time to go. Like they say, you know when you're ready, and I'm ready," end quote. The sheriff's office held a retirement reception Friday for Rowland, who has served in 8 positions within the department under 6 sheriffs. Sheriff Brian Gardner was hired at the Lynn County Sheriff's Office just a little after Rowland. After Rowland leaves, Gardner will be the oldest and most senior person in the department. Gardner said, "When you lose older people like this, you lose a bit of the history of the organization as well." Rowland spent most of his career working in the department's civil division, which is in charge of serving legal notices such as subpoenas, restraining orders, and no-contact orders. He's been the civil division commander since August 2017. He's also worked in the patrol division, general services division, and jail division. According to Gardner, Rowland became a statewide expert on civil matters during his time at the sheriff's office. Rowland said, "I've enjoyed all the different divisions I've worked in, but civil's where most of my knowledge is. It's unique. Everybody goes to the academy and gets trained on the same basic stuff, but civil is kind of a unique world all on its own." Rowland acknowledged Friday that it's rare these days for someone to stay with one department for an entire career, but he said he enjoyed his work with the Lynn County Sheriff's Office and never felt the need to leave, saying, "I've pretty much enjoyed every job that I've had here, so that's a big part of it, and the people I've gotten to work with over the years, that's what basically makes or breaks you, and I've been lucky. I've had good people to work with." At the reception Friday, Roland was presented with an outstanding service plaque and a retirement ID card by Gardner, and was given another plaque by his civil team. He thanked the attendees, who included several retired sheriff's office employees, and said he's grateful for everyone he had the opportunity to work with. And there's a picture of him receiving the plaque Friday from Sheriff Brian Gardner, and also a picture of a lovely cake with a deputy's badge on it and some pictures that have been kind of airbrushed on there with a congratulations for him and a happy retirement. And from the looks of it, this may be the last law enforcement article we shall see. This is also from Emily Anderson, titled Iowa City Police Investigating Shots Fired Call. Dateline Iowa City. The Iowa City Police Department is investigating a shots fired incident that happened late Tuesday night. Police were called to the area of Pepper Drive and Sandusky Drive at 11:30 p.m. for multiple reports of shots fired. Investigators think the reported shots came from a fight that happened about a half mile away in the 900 block of Cross Park Avenue. No one is believed to have been injured. And now, moving to something completely different, we have this article from Bailey. I'm thinking it's Cichon, C-I-C-H-O-N. Titled Five Seasons Ski Team Equipment Replaced After December Theft. Will the show go on? That's the question that stuck in the mind of David Lammers, co-director of Five Seasons Ski Team, when he heard that the team's entire sound system had been stolen in December. Lammers said, "We had already put in 3 months of work preparing for this summer's show. I wasn't even that angry. I was just in disbelief and fear that the show might not go on," end quote. The theft was a hard blow to the water skiing team, which won Best Sound in the Nation at the National Show Ski Tournament in Janesville, Wisconsin in 2014. Team President Ryan Furnish had found locks cut off the team's storage trailers and $11,000 of sound equipment missing. To this day, the equipment has not been recovered, and the culprit or culprits remain at large. Ryan Furnish said, "We originally thought replacing equipment was going to take us a couple years, or we'd have to use a lot of our budget, which we use for gas in the boats or costumes or ropes. Fortunately, that would not have to happen." Furnish told the Gazette that because of community donations, the team will replace the entire sound system by the first show of the season. As a thank you, the team will dedicate a special show June 8th to fundraising for a local nonprofit to be chosen by the team. "I just felt bad for those people that they had to go out of their way to steal something from this team," said skier Annalise Sanchez, age 15. Continuing, "Now it just makes me want to perform even better for the show, for the people, just as a thank you for everything they've done. Their support is just crazy," end quote. Five Seasons Ski Team performs free weekly shows on the Cedar River at Ellis Park from June through Labor Day. This year, the show theme is what Lemaire describes as the game of life, reimagined as a game show, reimagined as a ski show. No show will be the same, and audience participation is built into the show. The team competes in national ski competitions and most recently placed second overall at the 2022 National Show Ski Tournament in Rock Island, Illinois. This year marks the team's 45th season. And another story from Marissa Payne with a dateline of Cedar Rapids. Iowa awards Collins $1.85 million for microchip production here. Collins Aerospace, the city's largest employer, was awarded $1.85 million in state financial incentives toward the $22 million expansion of its Northeast Cedar Rapids campus to begin the production of microchips. The Iowa Economic Development Authority, also known as the IEDA, on Friday approved the incentives for the project by Collins, a division of Raytheon Technologies, to renovate an existing building on its campus between Collins Road and Blair's Ferry Road Northeast. State incentives include a $1.54 million investment tax credit and refund of $285,000 in sales, use, and service taxes paid during construction. This award supplements the local match the Cedar Rapids City Council approved on Tuesday, $1.05 million in tax incentives. The project calls for modernizing Collins facility and environmental controls for safe chemical storage and handling, water treatment and associated equipment, and furnishings with a Class 100 clean room, a manufacturing structure that uses HEPA filtration systems to keep the air clean. The company will use the building to develop and manufacture microelectronic microchip technologies for Collins Aerospace Communications products, with production expected to grow, City Economic Development Manager Caleb Mason said Tuesday. Under the deal points approved by the council, the company would renovate an existing 20,000-square-foot manufacturing building to create a 5,000-square-foot plating area, additional lab support and office space, and a $6,000 square foot Class 100 clean room. Of the $22 million minimum investment, $9.5 million would go toward the renovation and build-out of the facility, and $12.5 million would go toward machinery and equipment. Work would begin in April and finish by January 2026. The Cedar Rapids-based company currently employs nearly 7,800 people in Iowa, according to the IEDA. To receive financial incentives, the company must keep 25 existing employees and create no fewer than 16 additional full-time employees. At least 41 employees have to be paid at or above the high-quality jobs wage threshold of $25.20 an hour, generally in engineering and technical positions that pay well above that amount, Mason said. The city will provide three consecutive yearly payments of $350,000 in economic development grants starting in August 2025 through August 2027. Those grants will be funded from the Collins Tax Increment Financing District. Those three grants were consolidated to be awarded before the Tax Incentive District expires. I don't think we can underestimate the importance of these types of employees that are engaged in high-tech products, and having them in Cedar Rapids pays big dividends in the long run, Scott Overland, city council member, said Tuesday. Moving to the Gazette's Insight page, there is no local Gazette editorial, so we will read first the guest column that is written by Ann Carter and Circe Stumbo, who are described as Ann Harris Carter is a member of the Advocates for Social Justice, and Circe Stumbo is a member of the Marion Alliance for Racial Equity. And they have submitted a column that's been titled Coalition Seeks Healing and Rebuilding. They begin, on March 6th, the Gazette published an article about the case of Devonna Walker and Shane Teslick. We believe it is important to understand differing perspectives about this case. On January 2nd, Walker, a 29-year-old black woman, was stabbed. She died shortly thereafter. A video shows Teslick, a white male neighbor, yelling at Devonna, "I'm going to effing kill you and shut the F up, you effing the N-word." Devonna responded to his hateful and inciting taunts by rushing toward him. While the video provides a clear view of Shane stabbing Devonna, Shane was initially interviewed by police and released without being charged. On February 27th, County Attorney Nick Maybanks did authorize charges, voluntary manslaughter and disorderly conduct, and Shane Teslick was arrested shortly thereafter. During the 2 months between the taking of Devonna's life and the arrest of Shane Teslick, a coalition of social justice advocates engaged in actions to raise public awareness and to seek justice for Devonna, her family, and larger community. The coalition represents a diverse group of individuals and consists of a growing list of community-based organizations, including Advocates for Social Justice, Cedar Rapids NAACP Branch, Indivisible, Marion Alliance for Racial Equity, Parents Against Violence Everywhere, Stand in Unity, and We Are CR. As County Attorney Maybanks declared in his February 3rd news release, the loss of human life through violence is always traumatic to the community. The coalition is a witness to that trauma. Unfortunately, our coalition has been accused of provoking divisiveness and distrust through our actions of the past 2 months. We are saddened by these charges when it is clear to us that the racial divides in our country and community are well documented and predate us all. As we took to the streets to express our own fears about the Devonna Walker case and to channel feelings of hopelessness and despair communicated to us by our neighbors, we were not grandstanding. Our intention has always been to work across the community to repair harm, as the first step to repairing harm is to name it, and to fix policies and practices that have unfair implications for people of color. We have found that coming together to seek justice for Devonna in a coalition takes intention. Staying together is something we do not take for granted. We work hard to maintain collaboration, seek to understand different perspectives, and are committed to honoring the dignity of each of us in the coalition. We hope that our calls for action and communication help our entire community engage in reconciliation. We must talk about how the criminal justice system disproportionately impacts Black communities. We must disrupt the historical pattern that demonizes Black and brown victims, while the conduct and character of the white individuals who have committed offenses are essentially ignored. Devonna was a mother, daughter, sister, and neighbor. We must resist the ongoing degradation of Devonna's character, especially when juxtaposed to the relative silence about Shane's past. This case could take years to adjudicate. We hope you join us in the genuine healing and rebuilding. And again, Ann Harris Carter is a member of the Advocates for Social Justice, and Circe Stumbo is a member of the Marion Alliance for Racial Equity. And finally, from the Insight page, we have two community letters. The first from Dennis Muller of Springville, who says, "I moved back to Linn County about 3 years ago to retire. We bought a two-bedroom house on 2.5 acres in the middle of cornfields. It is an older house. The first year, the property was appraised at $30,000 more than the previous year. Now again, after 3 years here, property taxes increase another 32%. So, after living here 3 years, my appraisal has increased about $90,000. What is going on, Linn County? I thought Dubuque County was high. What are you going to raise next?" says Dennis Muller of Springville. And then the other community letter is from Mary Greer of Iowa City. It's under the title, "UI Healthcare Should Have Kept Mask Mandate." Ms. Greer says, "I am disappointed with UI healthcare leadership regarding the decision to withdraw the mask requirement. Patients come to receive care, not to unknowingly pick up a virus in a petri dish like a large university medical center. UI healthcare leadership should have required masks long before COVID arrived. It is a simple visual requirement that protects everyone. We can't see if patients are washing their hands regularly. University administration surveys staff routinely for opinions on our workplace, but failed to survey staff before implementing this change. We are experiencing an unprecedented staff shortage, building more facilities, and attending to more patients. Without masks on patients and visitors, more staff will become ill while performing their jobs." Ms. Greer says, "Please encourage medical facilities to keep mask mandates in place." You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, March 18th. On IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, we'll turn to today's obituaries. We'll start with the shorter death notices from Belle Plaine. Lewis M. Winslow, age 97, died Wednesday, March 15th. Rayback Newhouse Funeral Service in Belle Plaine is in charge of those arrangements. In Independence, Christine K. Hogan, age 55, died Sunday, March 12th. White Funeral Home in Independence is assisting the family. Dwayne L. Fromm, F-R-A-H-M, age 60, died Thursday, March 16th. Cruz Phillips Funeral Home in Tama is handling those arrangements. And from Tipton, Betty Jane Thuma, I guess previously Betty Jane Remke, age 94, died Thursday, March 16th. The family's being assisted by Fry Funeral Home in Tipton. From West Liberty, Edward F. Eichelberger, age 95, died Wednesday, March 15th. Those arrangements are being made through Henderson Barker Funeral Home in West Liberty. Also from West Liberty, Marilyn W. Little, age 92, who died Wednesday, March 15th, and those arrangements also are being made through Henderson Barker Funeral Home. We have several longer obituaries to share with you. First, from Iowa City, Patricia Christie Conlon passed away on Tuesday, March 14th, at the age of 88. Her funeral and visitation will be on Friday, March 24th at St. Patrick's Catholic Church, with the visitation from 10 to 11 in the church social hall, and then Mass of Christian burial at 11 a.m. at St. Patrick's. Then burial will be at St. Joseph's Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Iowa City Hospice or to your favorite local high school athletic booster club. The family issues a public thank you to Dr. Craig Champion and Mercy Hospital for the care they offered to her and the doctors and staff at UIHC. Next, from Ainsworth, Donald Krotz, K-R-O-T-Z, maybe it's Krotz, I'm sorry if I mispronounced it, who, age 62, passed away Thursday, March 16th at his home. Visitation will be held from 2 to 5 p.m. tomorrow, Sunday, at the Snyder and Hollenbaugh Funeral and Cremation Services of Riverside, and then the funeral mass will be at 10:30 a.m. Monday, March 20th at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Riverside, with burial at Mount Olivet Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Washington County Hospice or the Ainsworth Fire and Rescue in memory of Donald. Next is Henry Carl Schurer, S-C-H-U-E-R-E-R, age 35, who died at home on March 13th and was sometimes known as Hank by his Phi Gamma Delta fraternity brothers. It appears he had a strong contact with the Amana community, and the service celebrating Henry's life will be held from 2 p.m. Sunday, March 19th at the Amana Church, with burial immediately following at the East Amana Cemetery. Friends may come and greet the family from noon to 2 p.m. Sunday. They list the address as Church Alley, 622 45th Avenue in Amana. The family requests that in lieu of flowers, please direct memorials and tributes to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, NAMI, Iowa donation. I'm sure that if you know this family, you'll be able to contact them for more specifics on that. Funeral arrangements are being directed by Closter Funeral Home and the Amana Church Society. There's also a brief notice about a celebration of life for Richard Lerch, L-E-R-C-H. It just says, we will gather to share favorite memories, stories, and laughter about Richard Lerch, whose celebration of life will be from 3 to 6 p.m. tomorrow, Sunday, at the Fraternal Order of Eagles in Cedar Rapids. And our last local obituary is for Arlene, I don't know if it's Takes or Takes, T-A-K-E-S, Takes, age 85, of Cedar Rapids, died Thursday, March 9th. Visitation will be held from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. this Friday, March 24th, at St. Pius X Church, with the funeral mass following. A graveside service at Mount Calvary Cemetery will follow the mass. Included on the obituary page is one national obituary that may be of interest to some of our listeners. This is for John Jakes, whose generational sagas set during the American Revolution and the Civil War sold millions of copies and earned him the title of Godfather of Historical Fiction, died March 11th at a hospice facility near his home in Sarasota, Florida. He was 90. This is being reported through the Washington Post. His literary agent, Frank Curtis, confirmed the death but did not cite a specific cause. Jakes published more than 80 books in various genres, including science fiction and fantasy, but his deeply researched historical novels, more than a dozen were New York Times bestsellers, were the works that brought him commercial success, extraordinary wealth, and backhanded compliments from critics. Jakes acknowledged his goals were not literary. Rather, he sought to entertain and and educate readers who might buy his novels at Kmart without knowing anything about the era of American history he was dramatizing. For many readers, Jakes knew his books were their only source of history. "Sue me for not being Flaubert," he told People magazine. Jakes was struggling to make a living as a writer in the early 1970s when he published, I'm reading as the title is written, The Bastard, the first installment of an 8-volume saga about 7 generations of the fictional Kent family. The series, known as the Kent Family Chronicles, begins during the American Revolution and winds through other major historical events, including the War of 1812 and Texas's fight for sovereignty. He ultimately sold more than 55 million copies of Kent books. There was a TV miniseries. Jakes then turned to the Civil War, writing a trilogy focused on 2 families, the Maines, who owned slaves, and the Hazards, who were Pennsylvania industrialists. It too became a TV miniseries. Other historical novels quickly followed, including the Crown Family Saga. He was born March 31, 1932, in Chicago. After graduating from DePauw in 1953, he received a master's degree in American literature from Ohio State. He pursued a doctorate but dropped out because he, quote, couldn't dissect a sentence, he later said. Earlier, we had an article on the front page from Elijah Decius, and here we have another one from Elijah, and it is in the Living section under the title, Lest We Forget, Dateline Cedar Rapids. Before she could even read or write her own name, the only thing 4-year-old Tova Friedman still owned was turned into a number. "Okay, what's your name?" her tattooist asked after her prisoner number was tattooed into her arm at the Auschwitz concentration camp. "Tola Friedman," the little girl replied with her then-given name. "No, no," the woman replied, "that's not your name anymore. Repeat after me. Your name is 27633. Together, they patiently repeated the number, helping the child with no formal education memorize the way she would be required to identify herself at daily roll calls. Today, the number, unfaded both on her skin and in her mind, is proof of her experience to a world where her history is quickly fading from the public's memory. Friedman was 4 when she was sent to the labor camp with her parents, and 6 when she and her mother were packed into a cattle truck to go to Auschwitz II, known as the Birkenau extermination camp. Her father was sent to Dachau. After 6 months in Birkenau, she emerged as one of the youngest people to be liberated and one of only a handful of Jews to live after entering a gas chamber. For decades, she has spoken about how she and her parents survived Jewish ghettos and concentration camps. Soon, the newly minted author of The Daughter of Auschwitz, My Story of Resilience, Survival, and Hope, now 84 years old, will share her story in Cedar Rapids. After Friedman eventually immigrated to New York City at age 11, assimilating with other children was difficult in her Brooklyn community. She said it was very hard because nobody wanted to hear anything. I had to cover up my number, end quote. When a doctor offered to remove her tattoo, she refused. For Friedman, the memories that others need reminded of could not be erased, even superficially. In a 2022 BBC interview, she said, "There are a lot of things I don't remember, but the things I remember were so imprinted on my mind. You could not help but remember it. The body feels it. A child's body feels it. The hunger, the cold, the being alone without your family," end quote. Before she entered Birkenau and was separated, her mother prepared her. The Polish girl learned to always obey the rules, not to be visible, and never to make eye contact with Germans. When hiding under a blanket, she was taught to breathe into the floor so that she could not be detected as living. Friedman told the Gazette, "We all knew we were going to die. It was as normal as breathing. I understood that people disappeared. I knew death. I knew gassing, but I don't think emotionally any of us understand our own deaths, even as adults," end quote. Her most vivid memories include being beaten by a guard for fidgeting during the hours-long roll calls, one of multiple close calls with deaths. As her head sustained multiple blows, she locked eyes with her mother nearby, neither uttering a word nor a whimper they knew would jeopardize her life. To her, refusing to acknowledge the pain was a form of rebellion. She said, "I could have been killed right away. People were killed for less." Later, during her incarceration, she was taken with a group of children to a gas chamber. After waiting naked and cold for hours, they were sent back to the barracks. As one of the only people left in the world who entered the gas chambers and lived to tell her story, she still doesn't know how she survived. Friedman said, "I understood that once we were going through a certain door, we weren't coming back. I understood a lot. How much, I don't know." Before being liberated in January 1945, she survived Nazi killing squads making a final round through Birkenau by hiding among corpses. It was not until she was invited to speak in classrooms in the 1980s that she would start to show her tattoo to groups of children and later adults. With a rise in anti-Semitism around the world, the New Jersey resident said it's not only important for her to speak, but to listen to their questions. In addition to in-person lectures, the author connects with younger generations through TikTok, thanks to her grandson. Now, her visibility is her power in combating recurring cycles of hatred. Today, she doesn't feel a survivor's guilt, only a survivor's obligation to use her voice. Friedman said, "I don't know if my words will in any way affect someone, but if they understand the dangers and work against it, I've done my job." The Jewish woman still struggles with her faith. While she sometimes believes in God, her faith in humanity doesn't waver. That's why, after cycles of anti-Semitism throughout Jewish history, the latest waves of hatred don't frighten her as she continues to fight against it. She said, "There has always been anti-Semitism. There are good people everywhere. I count on these good people to keep humanity going and safe." With her number and her name intact, hope is what wakes her up every morning. She said, finally, "It's the one thing that the Nazis couldn't kill, our hope." And that article then was sort of a summary and a preview of what you will hear if you go to the Thaler Holocaust Remembrance ceremony or event, where the fund will welcome guest speaker Tova Friedman. She is, again, the daughter of Auschwitz, My Story of Resilience, Survival, and Hope author, and she will share her story through four appearances in Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Events are free, open to the public, and no tickets are required. There will be book signings following each event. Just in case this is of interest to you, those four dates are Sunday, March 26th at 7:30 p.m. for a community Yom HaShoah service in remembrance of the Holocaust at Coe College's Sinclair Auditorium. On Monday, March 27th at 6 p.m., she'll be at Cornell College's Thomas Commons in Mount Vernon. Tuesday, March 28th, she will speak at 1:30 p.m. in Kirkwood's Ballantine Auditorium at 6301 Kirkwood Boulevard Southwest in Cedar Rapids, and her final appearance will be on Wednesday, March 29th at 11:30 a.m. at Mount Mercy University's Chapel of Mercy. And if you or someone you know is looking for some things to do today, Saturday, March 18th, we have a few options listed here in the Gazette. Under the listing of community activities, Miracles Volunteer Training. Want to become a volunteer at Miracles in Motion? There is a training session. Actually, there will be two training sessions, one from 10 a.m. to noon today, which may be too late for that, but from 2:30 to 4:30 p.m., there's another one. And then there's a whole nother session on March 25th. You can, learn more at miraclesinmotion.com to find out more about that. The registration for that training is free. Also, as a community event, discover over a century of Cedar Rapids history during spring break at Bruce Moore. That's going to be from 10:30 a.m. of course, to 3 p.m. at Bruce Moore in Cedar Rapids. That cost is or was $5. Now, for music lovers, you've got quite a few choices here. The chamber series, Strumming Strings, will be held beginning, I think it looks like tonight at 7:30. This Orchestra Iowa program includes music from Defala, Mozart, Jesse Montgomery, Bernard Andrus, and Ravel. That's at 7:30 p.m., Opus Concert Cafe, 119 3rd Avenue in Cedar Rapids. It's free. Then there is Rear View, a Chicago-based band covering material from all of Pearl Jam's rich catalog. That's from 10 a.m. to midnight tonight at Riverside Casino and Golf Resort. It's free. Now, Brandon Santini, vocalist and harmonica player, they say is undeniably a worthy player to keep an eye on as the latest surge of young blues artists leave their footprint in blues history. If that's something of interest to you, you can see Brandon Santini at 8 p.m. tonight at the CSPS Hall on 3rd Street in Cedar Rapids. You can pay $25 in advance or $30 at the door. And the final music opportunity is from Beaker Brothers. This 7-piece band covers music from the Allman Brothers, Santana, Clapton, Little Feat, and others from the Golden Age of Rock, as they call it. That will be at 8 p.m. this evening, the Ideal Theater and Bar on 16th Avenue Southeast in Cedar Rapids. That cost ranges from $10 to $13. And I'm feeling creative today, so bear with me. I'm going to try to do something. In the TV section, there is a quiz titled Maternal Instincts. It's a trivia quiz, and I am going to read the question, give you a moment to think about it, and then I'll give you the answer. So we'll see how this goes. The first question is to name the three daughters of Carol Brady, played by Florence Henderson, on the Brady Bunch. Okay, we'll give you a minute to think about it. You got it? Well, they were Marcia, Jan, and Cindy. Marcia. Maureen McCormick, Eve Plum, and Susan Olsen were the actors playing those parts. Number two, on the series Maud, what was the name of the title character adult daughter? So who was Maud's adult daughter? Give you a moment to think about it. Her name was Carol, and she was played by Adrienne Barbeau. Ready for number three? Let's give it a try. Who played Joan Bradford, the mother on Eight is Enough, when the series began? Again, who played Joan Bradford, the mother on Eight is Enough, when the series began? Know who it is? That's Diana Hyland. This next question is sort of a historical question as well as just a TV trivia. In January 1953, what would that be, 70 years ago? Which television character famously caused a water flow crisis in America immediately following the episode in which she gave birth? 1953, water flow crisis, immediately following the episode in which she gave birth. Can you think who it is? Well, if you or someone you know or knew was a fan of I Love Lucy, you'll be able to answer this question, as that was Lucy Ricardo, of course, played by the legendary Lucille Ball. On this next one, I had to think about this one a moment. Number five, who was the mother of children nicknamed Princess, Bud, and Kitten? Who was the mother of the children on a series who were nicknamed Princess, Bud, and Kitten? Well, that was Jane Anderson playing the part of Margaret Anderson on Father Knows Best. We have two more. Number six, which actress earned much attention as a widowed mother and nurse in the 1968 through 71 comedy drama called Julia? So which actress got a lot of attention as a widowed mother and nurse in the comedy drama Julia, broadcast from 68 to 71? Can you think of it? That was Miss Diane Carroll. And the last question in this Maternal Instincts trivia quiz is, name the large family matriarch Emmy winner Michael Learned is famous for playing. large family matriarch Emmy winner Michael Learned is famous for playing. I sometimes watch this one still in reruns. I would say this is probably Michael Learned's most famous and treasured role of Olivia Walton on The Waltons. And I see here two very brief national notes that may be of interest to you or someone you know. This one is from San Quentin, the infamous state prison on San Francisco Bay that has been home to the largest death row population in the U.S., will be transformed into a lockup where less dangerous prisoners will receive education, training, and rehabilitation under a new plan from California Governor Gavin Newsom. The facility will be renamed the San Quentin Rehab Center, and the more than 500 inmates serving prison sentences there will be moved elsewhere in the California penitentiary system. And then out of Detroit, Ford is recalling more than 1.5 million vehicles in the U.S. in two actions to fix leaky brake hoses and windshield wiper arms that can break. The largest of two recalls covers nearly 1.3 million Ford Fusion and Lincoln MKZ midsize cars from model years 2013 through 2018. The company said in documents posted Friday by safety regulators that the front brake hoses can rupture and leak brake fluid. That increases brake pedal travel and makes stopping distances longer. So if you or someone you know owns a Ford Fusion or Lincoln MKZ midsize car model years 2013 through 2018, just know that there is a recall out for 1.3 million of those vehicles. Well, that does it for the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Saturday, March 18th. I've been your reader, Mary Neff, and it's been my pleasure to be with you. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thank you for listening.